a lot of people still suffer through training programs and jobs in medicine that they really dislike because they don't want to withdraw and feel like they're failing themselves, like they're failing the profession, like they're failing their family. And, you know, obviously even more than that, people have monetary demands and other things going on in their life, which make them unable to leave. But in my situation, I was able to take that step back. It was within my power and I just didn't. And then what ended up happening was that my body decided to take the break for me, which, you know, if you ignore the signs and you ignore your emotions and you suppress and suppress and suppress, one day, you know, you'll be gearing up to do a cannula and you'll be opening the cannula pack and your hands will be shaking so badly that you have to hand the job to someone else.
Are you a health professional wanting to explore all the options life has to offer? Then you've come to the right place. The Balanced Medics Handover podcast is all about living outside the box of what we've been told. I'm Isabella, your host, a junior doctor from Australia and trained coach. I'll be interviewing health professionals from all walks of life, artists, authors, non-clinical specialists, and more. These stories show that our choices are endless. Let's take the journey together. This is The Handover. Hello and welcome back to the Balanced Medics Handover podcast. This episode, we have one of my friends on, Dr. Charlotte Kachia. We met during internship and went through the 2 years intern residency together. And Charlotte's on to talk about her unique journey through medicine and her recent career change from one very different specialty to another. And I think this non-clinical specialty that she's jumped into, pathology, is something that maybe listeners might want to learn more about as well. So I'm really grateful to have her here today. Hey, Charlotte, how are you?
I'm well, thanks. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, it's thanks awesome for being to be here. Here.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm really excited to get into this and I really love your story. I think it's a really fun one for people to hear. Well, I know at times was not so fun, but
yeah, I think it's a fun one, but I mean, I also think that it's a really common one in a way. I think that a lot of people could really relate to my experience. And I was like quite vocal about talking about it sort of all the way through because I just hate this sort of pervasive attitude in medicine that we have, which is sort of like the, you know, Elsa-esque like conceal, don't feel sort of strategy where if we pretend that everything's fine and that we feel okay, and if we pretend that, you know, we don't really need to be happy at work to be fulfilled and have a fulfilling career, then it's all going to be fine. But I really don't believe that. And I think that everyone in medicine, whether you're in medical school or whether you're a doctor already, we've all worked too hard to settle for a career that doesn't fulfill us both academically and emotionally.
Yeah, I 100% wholeheartedly agree with that. I think that it's definitely a narrative that I hope we can start to change. And I think this conversation is a step in that direction, that it is what it is. There's no such thing as satisfaction, or there's no ability to be more satisfied, that you can change things to fit better for you and your life. So can you share with the listeners your journey through medicine and how you got to where you are now?
Yeah, so I guess I'll start at the very beginning. I graduated high school reasonably young, and all through high school I knew that I wanted to be a doctor. It was what I wanted to be when I was a kid. When people asked me when I was 4 or 5 years old what I wanted to do, you know, that was it. And I had like the little white coat and like doctor bag, you know, like full of plastic stethoscopes and syringes from when I was like such a young age. And it remains so consistent all the way through. And in high school I really slogged to try and get into undergrad because I'd seen the sort of difficulties that people had experienced trying to sit the GAMSAT and sort of trying again and again to get into medicine. And so I went into medicine straight from high school, studied at Western Sydney, the 5-year undergrad program. It was still MBBS at the time. And then I went straight from that 5-year program into internship and residency. And during that period, I worked at Hornsby with you. And particularly, it was an interesting period to start work, and I'm sure that you've already discussed this a bit on prior episodes as well, but like it was literally 3 weeks into our internship when COVID hit. And I think that looking back, for better or for worse, that really shaped our journey and the narratives of every single person who started work during that time. Because, you know, all of our bosses were saying, you know, this is incredibly unprecedented. You know, there was like a word that was thrown around so much at that time, like these unprecedented times. But for us, we sort of started out like in the pits. And like compared to other countries, you know, we had it so much better, but there was definitely that period of uncertainty, particularly during internship, where, you know, there wasn't enough PPE. Like my family was worried. Some people in my family were trying to encourage me to take, you know, a year off to avoid getting sick because we didn't know how bad this was going to get. So I think that that undercurrent of stress really shaped my attitude to work and really ended up shaping my choice of specialty. And during that period, I think I got stuck, as many people did, on several rotations that I sort of didn't expect to get stuck on. I did a lot of emergency medicine because of that. And there were parts of emergency medicine that I really loved. Like I loved the diversity of the cases. I wasn't particularly so interested or passionate about, you know, one organ or one system in medicine. Not passionate enough to go into BPT and subspecialize in that way. So I sort of set my sights on critical care. I've always been a very hands-on person, never wanted to work in an office. So that's kind of how I ended up doing a critical care SRMO year as a PGY3. And I guess like that's where it all sort of fell apart for a while as well. Because I started that year and it wasn't just the year itself, like the PGY3 year that was difficult. The problem was that the prior 12 months I'd done so much work already in critical care as a junior doctor without necessarily the confidence that a senior registrar would have. So you're sort of going to work quite apprehensive every day.
Yeah.
The shift load was quite extreme because, you know, people were always getting sick, you know, whether with COVID or something else, and people were put on mandatory leave. They were always, you know, underfilled shifts. We were always understaffed. Like, and, you know, obviously, as I've already said, in Australia, it was much better than other countries. But I think as juniors, a lot of people really did still feel the strain. And I definitely felt that strain. And after working in a few tertiary centres, you know, doing back-to-back shifts, I didn't take annual leave for a year and a half. And so by the time I got to my critical care year, I was already burned out.
Yeah.
Yeah. So like in that sense, it was a bit difficult because like there were parts of it that I really enjoyed. I did really enjoy the practical work. I really enjoyed the hands-on aspect. I enjoyed the academic aspect. But what I didn't enjoy was the relentless shift work from days to evenings to nights. I didn't enjoy the dismissive attitude of a lot of the patients. And particularly during COVID when emotions were really high, the sort of attitude that doctors and nurses and allied health staff got during those times was, I think, probably one of the most unprecedented things. Like we were having people, you know, I had people cross the road to avoid me, like as I was walking back to my car from work. I had someone verbally abuse me at a coffee shop for wearing my scrubs to pick up my takeaway coffee. Like just, and like it's small things, like really small things. But after years, you know, after 3 years, all of those small things, and when it's like so early into your career, really, really goes a long way to weigh you down because you're working so hard. And then on top of that, you're just getting, you know, kind of lambasted from all sides.
Yeah. And I think it's so key when you say all those small things add up because I think that is what burnout is. It's this slow, insidious creep of all these little things just piling together until you realize it often when you're just right in the middle of it, almost too late to prevent it, right?
Yeah, for sure. And I think like the type A, like I'm definitely a type A personality. Like I've always been an overachiever. I've always wanted to, you know, impress my bosses and do the best that I could and sign up for all the extra shifts and whatnot. And that attitude, you know, while it gets us here and while it makes us good at what we do and conscientious, it's an absolute double-edged sword because you end up not only overcommitting yourself, but people end up expecting that of you and of your colleagues because we're all so willing to just cop it as a community, I think, without complaint.
Yeah, 100%. It's a whole group of overachievers together overachieving, and it can only go so far. Like you said, it is a double-edged sword. I think having any talent, there's always the shadow of it too, and I think giving yourself so much and not having those boundaries, it really wears you down. If you don't have those strong boundaries set up.
Yeah, very much. And it's not even just like, but it's hard, right? Because, you know, it's about personal boundaries, but it's also about workplace boundaries. It's about a workplace's duty of care. And I think some hospitals are doing it really well. Like, I've worked at some centres where, and I mean, my career is quite short at this point, but in my experience, some centres are very good at supporting their juniors. You know, I was in a particular rotation when I was doing critical care where the bosses were checking in, you know, the senior registrars were checking in, they set up a mentorship program, you know, they did sort of all of that. And it helps, you know, like, it's not just nominal, it's really, really important. And it encourages your juniors to work harder and to work smarter and do better for the department, which is the real joke in the end, because a lot of centres do not appreciate that at all, like the importance of that HR aspect of things. And really, you know, the way that juniors in medicine have been treated for years is terrible. And we hear it all the time from a certain breed of consultant who have the attitude like back in my day. Mm. And whenever I hear that back in my day rhetoric, I actually feel really sad for them because it was terrible. You know, back in their day, it was terrible. We've come such a long way, but we still have a very long way to go, and we're not going to get anywhere by, you know, accepting that this is the status quo and this is how it's going to be, because we are all too bright to accept that. Like, we've worked too hard.
Yeah. 100%. I think just saying, well, this is how it is, doesn't really cut it.
Yeah.
I think also, you know, it doesn't really cut it. Yes, the old days had their challenges, but I think we have unique challenges now as well in modern times with, you know, electronic records, social media. Sydney is, a lot of places are oversubscribed for certain jobs. So things like, we have unique challenges as well. COVID to name one of
and
the many.
And also, like, even mortgage prices, like, that's actually a topic that comes up a lot in my reg room. You know, mortgage repayments and our salary and how, you know, the state government previous, thankfully the cap has been lifted now, but the wage cap that we were under for nearly 10 years and how that has impacted the profession. And I'm not a GP, so I won't really talk on it, but, you know, that whole, you know, issue with Medicare and Medicare rebates being absolutely ineffectual to keep up with the demands of work today for the amount of work that our junior doctors put in.
I agree completely with that. And, you know, I know a lot of GPs that do struggle with mortgage repayments, do struggle to make ends meet. And it doesn't really make much sense considering the amount we rely on GPs
for sure.
The healthcare system.
Yeah.
So you did touch on why medicine a little bit, that basically from a young age you had little toys, you just knew you wanted to be a doctor. What was your vision going into medicine in the beginning?
Well, going into medicine, I originally wanted to do general surgery. And I was interested in that for a while. Until I guess two things happened. The first thing was sort of disillusionment with the surgical profession. And there are a lot of very, you know, great trailblazing surgeons. I had a lot of good teachers as a medical student who were surgeons and are fantastic, you know, at what they do, but they're also fantastic mentors. However, I think that in general, and, you know, you'd probably have a surge reg on at some point who could speak to this far more eloquently than I can, but I think that the culture remains very sexist and very insular. It's not a culture that I personally like, to use some Gen Z lingo, like, I don't personally vibe with it. It's not a like a nice, well-rounded industry still. And it's still, you know, a lot of surgical subspecialties that we shall not name are still old boys clubs. A lot of my teaching was influenced by that, you know, male students getting preferential treatment. These were things that my classmates also complained about. So it's not just me, you know, having a whinge. And then the second reason was also that I enjoy medicine. And I really enjoy, like, pathophys, and I enjoy that whole side of things, which surgery, you know, it's so intellectually demanding, but you don't get as much of that, I guess, medical academic side unless you go specifically into academia and into lecturing. Whereas other areas of medicine, like critical care, you're exposed to different types of pathology every day, BPT even, although some BPT specialties lack the practical side of things. Like, they see some very complex, very interesting medicine. So I think that was the other reason as well why I sort of strayed away from that in my final years of medical school and more towards critical care initially.
And where did you want to go in crit care? What was the idea there?
So the idea was anesthetics, and the idea wasn't anesthetics necessarily for reasons of passion. Part of it was monetary entirely, and a big part of it was lifestyle. Because I thought, you know, the medicine's interesting enough. It's got that practical side. You know, you do get patient interaction, but predominantly your interaction is with other clinicians while the patient is anesthetized. So that part appealed to me for sure. And it's academically challenging. The problem was when I started doing anesthetics, I didn't enjoy it. I found it, you know, I found the theoretical side very interesting. I found the textbook learning interesting. And then the practical aspects of it, it felt like, and some people absolutely love this, it just wasn't for me, but going from zero to 100, you know, in the space of a few seconds, you know, the majority is you are monitoring the patient and the patient is stable, you know, if the anesthetist is doing their job correctly and it's a routine surgery. And then something goes wrong and you have to be on. And some people are so wonderful at that. You know, it's very temperament based, not just intellect based. Like you have to have the personality for that. I didn't enjoy that zero to 100 attitude. And then, you know, when the 100's fixed, you can just go back to kind of sitting down and monitoring your patient again. It's, you know, obviously a lot more complex than that, but it wasn't like it was quite stressful, to be honest. And critical care in general is stressful because you don't have time to sit back and make decisions. You have to know your stuff and you have to know it very quickly. And knowing my stuff isn't a problem, but the rapidity at which it's demanded in critical care was definitely not suited to my temperament.
Yeah. It is more of a stressful specialty, adrenaline, you know, high octane kind of specialty. Yeah.
And like a lot of the ED physicians, like, and a lot of the regs, you know, like they're triathletes. Yes. Like, you know, they run marathons, they all bike to work. Like it's a total stereotype, but like stereotypes don't exist in a vacuum because, you know, they're really into it. Like they've got, you know, they're super extroverted. They've got all this energy, a lot of them. And that is never who I've been. You know, I'm very introverted. I like to think things over. I like to sit back with a textbook and ponder things much more than you're able to do safely in critical care.
Yeah. That's so interesting that you say that, and maybe someone listening can just reflect on that about what their personality type is like and what they're drawn to. What prompted the change? I know we touched a bit on in PGY3, you were doing crit care, SRMO job. What happened? What did you do then?
Yeah, so we touched as well on the fact that by PGY3, I was burnt out. And I say by because it wasn't just in PGY3. It was really like death by 1,000 cuts from the very beginning, you know. And when I say from the very beginning, I mean since probably I first entered medical school. I entered, you know, really young, did undergrad, didn't take a break between medical school and internship. And not everyone needs that break. But for me, it was something that my body wanted me to take and my brain refused because I couldn't, due to my own pride and my own, I guess, hubris, take that break without feeling like a failure. And I think that a lot of people still suffer through training programs and jobs in medicine that they really dislike because they don't want to withdraw and feel like they're failing themselves, like they're failing the profession, like they're failing their family. And, you know, obviously even more than that, people have monetary demands and other things going on in their life, which make them unable to leave. But in my situation, I was able to take that step back. It was within my power and I just didn't. And then what ended up happening was that my body decided to take the break for me, which, you know, if you ignore the signs and you ignore your emotions and you suppress and suppress and suppress, one day, you know, you'll be gearing up to do a cannula and you'll be opening the cannula pack and your hands will be shaking so badly that you have to hand the job to someone else. And it was a crazy feeling. I've never felt anything like that before and I've never felt anything like that since. It was like my entire body just shut down. And at that point, you know, I realized like I am physically unwell. I was getting sick all the time. Like every 2 or 3 weeks, I'd get a new cold or flu. And this went on for about 6 months. I was so tired, even though I was sleeping all the time. And superficially, you know, I was doing fine. Like I was still socializing. I was still exercising. I was still eating well. I wasn't drinking away my problems. Like everything was fine because I was making it fine, if you know what I mean. Like, yeah. Everything in my brain was like, you have to be, you know, normal and continue normally, because if you take a break, then you are a failure.
Yeah, that's so huge.
Yeah. It's like, it was a big feeling. And like, I think that even in the aftermath of, like, and I guess we'll get to the article, but like even in the aftermath of that article, like I know that there were people who read that and went, how overdramatic. And I think at the end of the day, what I took out of this experience, beyond any change of career, beyond any of that, the way that I grew the most from that experience was realizing that other people's opinions do not matter.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing that and sharing your experience with burnout. I think it's huge that you are open about it. And like you said, not trying to make it like it's all good here, like you're like everything's fine, admitting to it and sharing it so other people can feel like it's more normal than you think. And it actually is.
Oh,
like,
God, statistically, it's so normal. Yeah.
It's more, and it's the average.
Yeah. It's that. And like, even if it's not while you're so junior, maybe it's during your training exams, which is, you know, another incredibly stressful time in any trainee's life. Maybe it's, you know, 20 years into consultancy. It doesn't matter. Like, it's important to talk about it because, you know, we are all human. I would say, you know, I'm not sure what the stat is, but I would say a lot of doctors would experience burnout at some point.
Over 70% is the current stat.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what did you do when your hands were shaking? You handed the cannula pack over. What was your next step?
My next step was to, well, make sure my patients were safe. I was covering the recovery ward at that time. So everyone was, you know, reasonably stable. Thankfully, we weren't understaffed. So there was another JMO to pick up my slack, and I just said, hey, I'm really sorry, I've got to go. And basically, I went and sat in my car for a while and had a good think about it. And then I went to the JMO unit and requested emergency leave. And the reason I requested emergency leave was, rather than quitting immediately, is because I think decisions like that shouldn't be made when you're in a heightened emotional state. I think that you do need, you know, regardless of how stressed and depressed you're feeling, to step back and really think over your options. And thankfully, my JMO unit at the time was actually very understanding of this, and they dealt with it, they said, quite a few times before, and especially during COVID, and even in the past 12 months, they said at least 5 other people had come to them with similar requests for emergency leave, and a lot of them didn't come back. And so I took my 3 weeks, and by the end of that period, I decided that it wasn't just a knee-jerk emotional reaction. One, I needed a rest, and two, the career path that I was pursuing at that time wasn't compatible with who I am as a person. So I decided to take the rest of that year off and to locum to earn a bit of money during that time and to reconsider my options during that period.
Yeah, it's so great that your JMO unit gave you the emergency leave, and also that you were able to ask it and take that time away to figure out what your next steps were. And you're right, it is, I think when you're really burnt out, you just want to escape.
Yeah.
Whatever means necessary to not feel the way you're feeling, but taking the step back, taking the time is so key.
Yeah, definitely. No decisions made in haste.
Yes, yes. Yeah. So then how did you find out your next step then? You know, you had the year off and you were thinking about what to do next. Were you thinking about leaving medicine altogether? Were you looking at other specialties? What was your thought process then?
Yeah, well, initially I was very strongly considering leaving medicine. However, at the time I also recognized that that was probably, you know, speaking of an emotional reaction to the state of heightened stress that I was in at that time and the state of disillusionment that I was in at that time with the whole field of medicine, due to that sort of aforementioned death by a thousand cuts. And so I sort of decided to wait to think about it for at least 2 months. And I gave myself that time to do things that I enjoyed and to take time out with my family and to see friends and to take a step back completely. Like, no work was done during that time. And I know that, you know, a lot of people are not in a position to do that. And I know how lucky I am to have been in that position as well. For me at that time, that was really, really key. And then the more time that went by, the more interested in medicine I became again. And I guess the more I remembered how I felt before the burnout and the reasons why I went into medicine in the first place. Because, you know, through medical school, you know, before getting into medical school, I was always really passionate about it. So it's not like I started from a benchmark of, oh, this will do. Like, I was always really into it up until that point. And so for some people, I think taking that time away, if they realize that actually they've never been passionate about it and they've just been doing it, you know, for the sake of family, friends, you know, myriad reasons, then they might decide to walk away completely. And that's completely fair. For me, that wasn't sort of the truth of what I felt. And with that distance, I was able to realize that. And then after realizing that I wanted to stay in medicine, it became even more difficult because I was like, God, what am I going to do now? Like, what specialty am I going to do? And will they take me back? And I mean, thankfully, when I left my previous job, I left with goodwill. So I left with references. I sat down and spoke directly to my supervisors rather than just speaking to the JMO unit and sort of ghosting everyone. I made sure to email the people who had supported me directly and inform them about what was happening and explain, you know, not my deepest feelings, but why I was leaving and my reason. And actually, I think they appreciated that.
Yeah.
And so it was a very sort of clean breakaway, but I got to take my references forward. So I would recommend trying to preserve that goodwill and not burning bridges for anyone who is even remotely considering coming back to medicine in the future, because you are going to make your life so much easier by maintaining those connections with people who you worked for. And so then, you know, while I was considering, I went to careers counseling and I found that extremely helpful. It's not something that I'd ever considered doing before, nothing that I did even during high school, because I always knew what I was doing and I felt really lost because I'd always had this very direct path to the top. And now I was just sort of adrift going, not sure what's coming next. Should I just do a general SRMO year, you know, and sort of, you know, work out where my feet are again. And the careers coach said something that was, you know, quite profound in my situation, which was that what's the point of doing a general SRMO year unless it's going to get you somewhere very specific, because you've already done the rounds. You've seen every pathology, you know, every sort of range of medicine that there is during your internship and residency. So now it's time to actually give something a go. And then if that doesn't work out, then at least you can say that you've tried without regrets and without sort of faffing around for another year. And as part of that careers counseling, there was personality testing, discussions about my interests outside of work, what I prioritized as a person. And people's priorities are really different. Like, I think in medicine, a lot of people are very work focused. There's not much time for hobbies and for enrichment outside of medicine. A lot of people really do just find enrichment in the specialty that they choose. For me, I've always had a million hobbies. I leave, you know, a lot of things half done because I'm always sort of flitting from this to this to this. And I think that that's what attracted me to critical care initially. But I wanted to keep that time, and because that's what also fulfills me. And work is enjoyable and it's interesting, but for me, I need more than just work. Like, I need a rich life external to my career as well. And so that ruled out a lot of specialties, you know, in one blow, because a lot of specialties in medicine are incredibly time consuming. They're incredibly demanding. I considered doing GP because GP is also general. It has, you know, everything that I like to do. It has a lot of interesting pathology, but I couldn't bear the thought of sitting in an office all day. And I couldn't bear the thought of sort of seeing patient back to back to back, because as a very introverted person, that's draining. It's really tiring for me. And so then the careers counselor I saw said, you know, have you ever considered doing pathology? And I was like, well, actually, like, my uncle is a pathologist and he you know, we never really talked seriously about it and he never really encouraged me to do it. We just haven't had any conversations along those lines. In medical school, the histology we learned was super boring. Anatomy was always my worst subject, is the only exam in my life I've ever failed. So I was like, no, of course I've never considered doing pathology. Like, are you joking? And she said, well, maybe like go away and have a read and think about it. And so I went away and had to think about it and talked to some of the registrars who were already in the program and realized that a lot of what anatomical pathology specifically had to offer was right up my alley. The range of pathology is huge. It's every system, every organ in the body is covered by this specialty. You know, every specimen from surgery, from whatever specialty of surgery you're doing, comes to us. And so that part appealed. Half of the work is cut up, which is where it's you with a range of blades, a range of surgical implements, macroscopically assessing the specimen and taking sections which show appropriate surgical margins so that they can be put onto a slide. And those sections are really important. And the range of stuff that you see is exciting. It's really hands-on as a registrar. And then the other half, to me, is extremely academic. So one of the things that I was warned about with anatomical pathology was that it's really, your time is demanded by study. So even though your work hour is good, you have to go home and you have to slog even more than a lot of other specialties because you're really sort of starting from scratch. You know, you don't know histology at all. You don't know one organ from another when you first go into that training program. But for me, the academic side has never been the problem. I've always been willing to study. I've always been interested to learn and excited to learn. A lot of people don't feel that way, and I totally get that. They'd rather work a shift and just go home and tune out. I would rather finish at 5 and come home and study in the comfort of my own house. So for me, that part wasn't a problem. It was actually sort of appealing. And also, I don't have to talk to patients. I only have to talk to other clinicians. For me, that's a big draw. And so, yeah, that's sort of how I fell into it. And so I sort of said, well, let's just give it a go then and I'll apply for the training program and see how we go in the next 12 months.
Yeah. And now you're a pathology registrar. Can you tell us how it is? What are the requirements maybe just starting off with that and how would someone apply if they were interested?
So almost 12 months in to anatomical pathology. It's hard work. Because it's intellectually demanding. Mm-hmm. But I like that. I like that it demands constant learning and constant study. And I like the fact that it's textbook heavy and it's academic and it's a lot of looking at slides. For some people, that's a complete turnoff. You know, looking at slides is the most boring thing in the world. It's not that exciting. For me, it was boring to begin with. And then the more you learn, the more interesting it becomes because the more you begin to correlate the pathology that you see in the patient to the organ with your own two eyes, to the pathology that you see under the microscope with your knowledge of pathophysiology. And so that all marries together for, you know, every organ system. And you can subspecialize later on in your career, but at a junior registrar level, you have a very broad scope of what you're looking at and what you're expected to learn. And so that learning is demanded of you every day. I really enjoy the practical component of it. That's something that I would miss if I became a consultant in anatomical pathology because they're very slides-based. They don't do cut-up anymore. That's a registrar job. But for now, you know, we'll cross that bridge when we come to it. But for now, that practical side is really, really enjoyable. I'm on my feet a lot, which I like. It's constant different cases coming in, some really wild and wacky stuff, particularly over the holiday period where only the emergency lists are on. So yeah, it's been really, really good. What I would say to anyone considering it is to definitely talk to people directly who are registrars, not just people who are consultants, but people who are doing the training program, because the exams for anatomical pathology and any form of pathology in general are notoriously difficult and there's a lot of them. So even though your hours are Monday to Friday, you know, 8:30 to 5, it's great compared to other specialties. There's minimal on-call, if any at all, depending on your center. You don't work weekends. You never work nights. It's fantastic. You'll never feel more awake in your life, especially if you've come out of internship and residency or something like critical care where you're constantly doing shift work. So that side is great. But, you know, the study demands are I look at the registrars approaching their part one exams and they are haggard. Like, they are seriously studying their butts off. So that is not something to take for granted. Like, it's not a specialty to go into if you're kind of expecting a jolly time and an easy ride through, because that's not kind of how it works. There's a lot of knowledge to acquire in a really short space of time, and 5 years is very short. But if the work appeals to you, the lifestyle really complements it. Like, it's excellent and I couldn't recommend it more. I have, you know, despite the study, I still have time to exercise. I sleep at the same time every night. I have my weekends free. You know, I get to see my friends and family. That side is amazing. So I would highly encourage you to speak to people who are registrars in the field to get a feel for what the exams are like, what the study requirements are like, and what the pros and cons are in greater detail than I guess I'll go into here. And I would encourage you to, after doing your research, have a good read through the college website and the college requirements. There's no requirement for you to have done a pathology rotation. In fact, most hospitals do not even offer it. They're, you know, few and far between. All they expect is a decent foundational knowledge in a lot of general specialties of the sort that you'd get in internship and residency, and they expect you to be diligent and eager, like any specialty. So at that point, it's not so much sort of getting in that is the problem, although it has become oversubscribed in the past few years and they have started knocking people back. But I think that being aware of those study requirements is really essential before you look into applying.
Yeah, that's some really great advice. And thanks for sharing a bit about the day-to-day as a junior reg, and reaching out to someone that's already doing the training program is really great to see what it's about, and then knowing the highlights and then also the challenges, which is that it's quite rigorous academically and there are a lot of exams. Mm. Now, I want to know, what would you say to your intern self?
Well, you know, it's funny because what I would say, like, my intern self would never listen to because, like, she wouldn't be ready to hear it.
Yeah.
For context, like, for listeners, my intern self, like, I was 21 when I graduated medical school and now I've just turned 26. And so during that period, you know, I'm still quite young, like, compared to my fellow registrars, you know, even in the same year as me, like, I am quite junior. And so, you know, in 5 years, I'm sure that I will have gained a lot more wisdom than I have now. However, I'm a lot wiser than I was at 21 when I just graduated from university, from my undergrad degree with no life experience, no experience in the workforce at all. What I would say is, go easy on yourself. Don't overcommit to things. It's okay to feel stressed and it's okay to feel sad and it's not shameful to feel like you're not coping. And in fact, if you do reach out to your supervisors and to your JMO unit, they may be a lot more helpful than you think that they are. Yeah, I would just say don't be so hard on yourself.
Yeah.
And, like, you know, life never works out the way that you think it will, ever, for anyone. And if it does, then, you know, people are still unsatisfied.
Yeah, that's true. That can also be it. Yeah, I think it can be stressful at times, maybe when you're not sure what's next. Mm. But then you can, a lot often things work out better than you can expect. And it's a surprise, but it's a nice surprise.
Yeah, it's a great surprise. And, like, how boring would it be if everything worked out exactly how we expected? And how terrible it is. Or it would be, I think, to reach the end of something and not be passionate about it. And maybe that sounds a bit naive. Like, you know, maybe older listeners would think, you know, oh, like, you know, passions for people in their 20s and, you know, idiots with too much money and time on their hands. But from my perspective, like, I'm in a privileged position. You know, I'm not tied down. You know, I want to have children, but I don't have children yet. You know, there's a lot of these privileges that I have and that I recognize that I have. And a lot of interns just coming out of medical school are in the same situation as me and the same situation that I was when I graduated, you know, really young and quite inexperienced. And now what I would say is, it's the perfect time to screw up. It's the perfect time to explore. It's the perfect time to make mistakes, to enter a field that you don't like, to start something and go, oh God, you know, I'm dreading going to work every day. This is terrible. Let's try something new. I think the biggest mistake that anyone could ever make is to be in your 20s and think that, you know, the world is ending here and life stops here and the passion stops here because this is where I've found myself, so this must be all there is.
Yeah, I think you answered my next question of what you would say to a doctor who's unhappy with their current circumstance.
And God, yeah, exactly the same thing. Make a change because it is, you know, like it is never too – I watched a really good documentary the other day. It was about the only woman to ever swim a long-distance swim between Cuba and Florida. Wow. And she attempted this swim when she was really young, you know, like in her 20s and her 30s and failed. And then when she was in her 60s, I think she was 62, she decided to try again. And she tried again and again and again, failed every time. And then at 60, I believe she was 64, she became the only person, not just the only woman, not just the only, you know, elderly person, blah, blah, blah. 64, she became the only person ever to complete that swim. It is the longest distance that a human has ever swum. And so to anyone listening to this, particularly if you are young and in your 20s and unattached, I would say you are selling yourself short, man. Like, you know, if she can do that, like if humans can complete incredible feats, you know, if we can go to space, you know, if you can get into medical school when it's such a competitive climate and come out as, you know, a young doctor with the world open to you, why settle? Why settle for something that you don't like?
Exactly. And, you know, you've come this far, you've gotten into medical school, you've graduated, you're working in the hospital. Most listeners are in that kind of situation. To get there takes a lot of resilience, a lot of hard work, it's rigorous academically and physically and mentally. And you've done that and you have so many skills. And I think not having the limits on yourself, looking outside the box and being open to all the possibilities, because there are so many things out there that often we're not even aware of when we're junior.
Yep, massively. And like everyone's journey, like as you well know, is incredibly different. And what fulfills people is incredibly different. I talked to a lot of registrars and other specialties who are like, I don't understand how you could do path. It's so boring. Slides are so boring. And to that I say, yeah, for sure. Like I totally understand that perspective. Like, to a lot of people, my job is completely boring. To me, it's exciting.
Yeah.
And to me, I get to go to work and be excited and passionate about what I do. And I'm early in training. I'm not, you know, my part one exams are not for another year. So check back in with me in 12 months and see how jaded and disillusioned I've become. But I think that is the feeling that you want to chase, because life is, you know, there are a lot of logical decisions. We're all very good at making logical, well thought out decisions, but those decisions have to be guided by your guiding star and your interests and your passion.
Which is interesting you say that, because when you were describing your reason behind going into crit care, it seemed very logical, the decision, but it didn't seem very with the heart. And when you were saying that some people find it boring, but you find it exciting, that's all that matters, because you're the one doing it. So,
oh, exactly. Yeah, for sure. Like, and I think every specialty in medicine I've considered at least once, like during my year of indecision and soul searching. And every specialty has a long list of pros. Like, people always talk about the cons to everything and how bad everything is and how, you know, crappy XYZ specialty is. But when I was making lists, and because that's the sort of person I am, like I was, you know, writing down lists of pros and cons for everything, there were pros to absolutely every specialty. There are things in there. And while I was doing that, I thought, you know, of course someone would be passionate about this. Of course this would make someone excited. And then for some people, leaving medicine might be the right decision. If you can't find passion and you can't find interest in anything and you're really done, like, I mean, really done, after taking the time and really considering, a medical degree will never stop you from getting into any other course at university that you might want to apply to.
Yeah. Yeah. You can completely change. And that's what this podcast is all about.
Yeah.
There's a huge breadth within medicine, clinical, non-clinical. You can leave medicine for industry. I did that for a year, working for clinical research for pharmaceutical companies. Now I'm back in the hospital. Like, that's the other thing as well. You don't have to, if you do leave, it's not like, oh, you can never come back either.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. So you can change constantly.
Yeah. and change constantly. And like, I think the only shame in the end would be not living up to who you could be and not achieving your peak level of satisfaction with your career because you care so much. You care more about what other people think than you care about what you feel.
Yeah.
I think that's, you know, that would be the biggest shame.
Yeah, and I think personally anyway, even if you are meeting other people's expectations, you still don't feel good.
Oh, for like sure.
So it's like, it's like, like,
that's, you think you will, but you don't.
Like, yeah, so it's like, that's obviously not working. So probably it's time to try a different way.
Yeah, that's so true.
Yeah. Now I ask this of everyone, it's Balance Medics. What is balance to you?
Balance to me is being able to get at least 7 hours sleep every night, not day, night. And coming home from work satisfied that I have learned something new and then engaging in a hobby that makes me feel fulfilled. And to me, that's balance, like having that work that interests me and that I'm passionate about, but then also having that other complement of, you know, relationships with family and friends, hobbies that you love, you know, having a rich, full life that isn't just work, work, work. Like, to me, that is like peak balance, having satisfaction in both of those domains.
Yeah. Like, I just think work, play, and sleep, having those.
That's all you need, man.
Yes, I love that. Now, it's been so great chatting. I could keep chatting, but I'm mindful of the time. Is there anything else you'd like to add that you think would benefit the listeners?
I have a very off-the-wall one,
yeah,
which is that all the way through school, I hated sports and I was really bad at sports. And PE was my least favorite subject. And I assumed that I would never be good at sports. And then I discovered after graduating medical school that there is a sport for everyone. So you've just got to find your sport. And it doesn't have to be a team sport, but being active is, it really does make you feel better. It's like the advice that you get from everyone to the point where I am like, oh my God, I can't believe people are still saying this. But like, it's actually true. It's like taking a walk outside in the sun. Like, it actually does make you feel better.
Yes.
But yeah, what I would say is find a sport that you like. There's a million sports in the world. But also, that's kind of a metaphor for like everything. Don't just do the sport, like the team sport that everyone kind of enjoys and everyone thinks you should enjoy. Find a weird sport like curling or something that you enjoy.
Yeah. Yeah. It is a metaphor. It does like fit for everything, finding the sport that's right for you. And it is, I know what you mean by that. Like, sometimes I'm like, you know, things that prevent burnout, moving your body, sunlight. Yeah. And everyone's like, oh, like hydrating, sleep. Like, everyone's like, yeah, whatever.
I've heard this a million times before. But it's true. Please shut up.
But it's true. It's, I promise. True. Yeah. That's great. Find the sport for you, whether it's like bobsledding or I don't know.
Oh, exactly. Yeah. Anything.
Yeah, anything. Now, how can people find out more about PATH? I just want to put a quick shout out as well to your article. If people want to hear more about your story, you wrote about your experience. So, yeah, how can people look out for those?
Well, I think, one, the college website would be the most generic answer. They do have a lot of good information. Two, groups like Dr. Doc, which is a women's group, and groups like Creative Careers in Medicine, which is mixed gender, any gender you like, I would recommend not just making a post in there, but searching back, because a lot of people have dropped their Facebook contact links in the comments just to say, hey, I'm open to chatting. I am open to an email from anyone. So you can email me with any questions you like. If you want to talk to a more senior registrar than myself, I can put you in touch with, you know, a myriad of people who would be more than happy to chat. So yeah, I think college website for official information and registrars for the unofficial information that the website won't tell you.
Yeah, that's great. And how about your article about your experience of burnout? And
sorry, what about it?
How can people find that? Where is that?
How can people find it? Oh gosh. How can people find that?
BBC.
I know. SBS.
SBS. I was like, yeah. Yeah, SBS. I'll put the link in the show notes.
I've actually forgotten where it is.
That's okay.
Yeah, please put the link in the show notes. It is on SBS. It was published last year in around September or October. So it's a little bit outdated now, I think, on their website. You might not be able to find it through there, but yeah.
Okay. Just
follow the link.
All right. So I'll put the link in the show notes for that. Also, I'll put your email address if you're happy with that and the college website.
Yep.
All right.
No worries.
So thank you for coming on. It's been so great.
No, it's been awesome. Thank you so much for having me.
You've been listening to the Balance Medics Handover Podcast. If you've enjoyed what you've heard, I'd love for you to take a minute to rate and review this podcast and click the follow button. For more resources, check out the Balance Medics website. The link to this will be in the show notes below. See you next episode.